What things should you consider when you are about to publish a book? This is a first of three episodes to deal with the publishing side of write, publish, and repeating. And we're going to talk about some of those questions you probably have. Should you go wide or should you just put your books on Amazon? And why? Stay tuned.
Write, publish, repeat. It echoes through the air. A chorus for creators. A call to those who dare. With cookies as his compass and a pen that won't retreat, he journeys through the pages. Write, publish, repeat.
Welcome to Write, Publish, Repeat, episode 4 already of this new season. Today we're talking about how do I publish my book. We're going to go over some of the basics on, you know, what you have to consider when you're publishing a book. And yeah, that's it. It's all part of the write, publish, repeat trio of things.
So we're in act two, is what you're saying. I think they refer to this as the messy middle. Is this going to be where we're all sloppy and the slog and the next?
Oh, no, I'm good. I'm good to go. No sloppiness here. No all sloppy right. Second act for Dave. All right.
All right. I'm really happy to hear that.
All right, so this is Sean Platt, the Big Nose, in case you're tuning in for the first time ever. And yeah, we start off with something cool. So do my something cool, or are you ready with a something cool?
Yeah, something cool. What is your something cool?
My something cool is a podcast I found, you know, when I'm going back and forth to pick my son up and shit. So when I'm with my family, I have to, like, listen to music and stuff that they want to hear. But when I'm on the solo trips, I can listen to a podcast. So I found one. It's interviewing writers. It's called Always Take Notes. Have you heard of it? It's been around for a while.
But I really like that title.
Yeah, and they just interview an author each. I think they do every 2 weeks. They do an episode, and they interview them, you know, about, you know, their life, whatever. And right now I'm listening to Lee Child. I didn't even know he was British.
He was British.
Yeah, and he's talking about, you know, how he got into writing, how he come up with the BBC and was doing, like, television stuff for them, and they had his whole political thing, but basically, like, they were trying, Rupert Murdoch's, you know, company was, like, fucking everything, and basically the Conservatives screwed up what the BBC had going in such a way that they had to play ball to exist, and he was out the door, and then he started his writing career, and, you know, now he's, like, mega successful, and he recently, or at least as of the recording, he's been writing with his brother, who he's having do the books.
Oh, that's fun.
So, yeah. And I thought it was interesting. Like, I like hearing writers talk about, you know, their process, even if it's a writer that I don't even read or am interested in, like, their fiction. I always am interested in the other side of it, so.
Yeah, that sounds great. If I had time to listen to podcasts these days, I would totally do that. But you know what I've been doing a lot when I walk is, like, listening to outlines.
Well, if you'd like to pick my family up and bring them to work and school and stuff, you're more than welcome.
That's okay. But I do feel your pain. So I'm going to give my something cool to Blink Twice. Have you heard of Blink Twice?
The horror movie?
Yes. Yes, it is. It is a horror movie.
How long ago was this? I feel like I've seen it.
No, it just came out on streaming like an hour and a half ago. I mean,
oh, then I did not see that yet.
A week ago, 2 weeks ago. Yeah, this was one that I followed in pre-production because it was attention getting. It's Zoe Kravitz's directorial debut, and I like her. And it was originally called Pussy Island, and it is it's really confrontational. And I have not decompressed with Cindy about it, so I'm not sure. I'm not sure how she liked it. She was definitely in on the first half, but it gets progressively darker and darker and darker. But I think you'll really like it. It deals with, it has a lot of Dave tropes in it. It's basically billionaires are evil and everyone will exploit everyone else if given the opportunity.
So it's a documentary, you're saying?
It's a documentary. But it has good twists and turns. I could absolutely understand why somebody wouldn't like it. And it starts with a trigger warning, and it's an earned trigger warning. So I'm not recommending this for everybody. But I am saying that it is one of the best post Me Too movies that I've seen. Like I would put it up there with like, it's not as good as Promising Young Woman, but I enjoyed it. You know, it's horror that does all the things a good horror movie is supposed to be. You know, it's supposed to do, like, really of the time, and the cast is great. Did you watch The Old Man?
The show?
Yeah.
I saw the first season. I haven't seen the second one.
Okay, so you know Angela, who is also in Arrested Development?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, so she's in it. She's great. And Channing Tatum is the billionaire.
Okay, I can see that.
And Christian Slater's in it.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's. Oh, Gina Davis is in it, and I haven't seen her in forever, but she's in it, and her character is super, super, I mean, interesting is a big word, because I just love what they did with her character, basically. She's kind of a walk-on, but they give her character gravity because her character has, well, I can say it's not even really a spoiler. Her character is like thematically exists to say how too many women are just kind of complicit with the way things are, because they're like, oh, men are going to do it anyway. So like, might as well just play along. Right.
Make as well make your money.
Yeah, just like not holding people in positions of power accountable and just kind of going along with it.
That's fucked up.
So anyway, I do think that like this is not a something cool for the general audience, although I think some people will definitely think it's cool, but specifically you will really like this movie.
Now, speaking of, you know,
Okay,
so speaking of my tropes, you know, putting kids in danger is one of my big tropes in my fiction, not in real life.
I would say arguably your biggest.
but I don't like to see it. Like, I was watching American Primeval, and there's a scene where there's a young boy in it, like the son of one of the main characters, and gets knocked off of a horse and then kicked in such a way
that
his leg breaks and a bone sticking out, and I was like, oh, I can't do this. Like, I was like,
that was hard to watch, dude.
Oh, you saw it?
Oh, yeah. I saw American Primeval.
Didn't know you'd watched it. Okay.
No, I watched it a couple weeks ago. I thought it was great. I really, really liked it. I still think you need to see 1883. 1883 is, I mean, we were one episode in, and it's hard to get better than the best episode of American Primeval, because it has that long tracking shot with the first assault.
Yeah.
And I don't know how long it is. It's several minutes of no cuts, and it is phenomenally well done. And so we were after that, and I said to Cindy, so what are the odds of, you know, this being as good as 1883? And we agreed that, like, even if every episode was as good as that one, no way it's as good as 1883. Like, it's so, so good. You should.
Well, I like it. It fits that niche of, like, Western television that I kind of enjoy, like Hell on Wheels and stuff, like got a similar vibe. And it is a show that like anyone has any notion of like, oh, I would love to have lived back then, that will dispel you of that very quickly, because the whole world is just out to get everybody. It reminds me of the Far Cry games, the open world games. Like, you are on this island and you're a soldier or whatever your role is, and you might save somebody that's being mauled by a tiger, and then they're going to walk away, and not even 20 seconds later, another wild animal is about to kill them. It's like, it's just comical how awful the world is, and that's how this series feels.
Well, it is, and it's brutal. It's the same thing with 1883, but on a more human level. I mean, there's a lot that I liked about Primeval. Like, I mean, I think Primeval was A, but 1883...
Is that one and done, or is there a cliffhanger?
I think, I think it was... You know what? I just assumed it was a limited series, but I could see that coming
back. I hope there's more. Okay.
I mean, they definitely put some big weight behind it. I don't know. Has Peter Berg done much TV?
Like, oh, yeah. He did a lot, like, early on. He was on Chicago Hope.
oh, okay, all right. Well, maybe. I would love to see it as a recurring show. I would totally watch it. 1883, I'm glad that it was just a limited series because it's more powerful because of it. But you were really telling one family story where American Primeval is telling, like, a story of the American West. And, you know, not to, like, pound on the Mormons or anything, but it was cool to see the Mormons as a bad guy because we don't normally see that. Like, it was a new bad guy in the Western, you know, landscape.
All right. Well, now that Sean's alienated all of our Mormon listeners, all two of them.
I have no issues with the Mormons whatsoever.
I'm just fucking with you. I know.
I do think that it was cool to see, you know, to see that side of
history. Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. And was that also in 1883? Did they have the Mormons? I thought they did.
No, oh, okay. No, but they had a fort a lot like that. And we, dude, just see 1883. Like, I listened to the Kendrick Lamar album. You need to watch 1883.
All right, now that we've wasted everybody's time, let's get on with the show. And yeah, we're going to talk publishing. So the first thing you have to decide when you're going to publish a book is, do you want, let's say you've already written it or you're almost done with it, do you want to be a traditionally published author and get a book deal, or do you want to be an indie author, independent author, and do everything yourself? And we've done both, and I think there's a lot more freedom in independent publishing. But the flip side of that is, if you don't like to do all the stuff, all the marketing and the production of the actual book, the editing and all that stuff, well, that is where traditional publishing can help you a lot. I don't know. Marketing is one of those areas we've talked to people that they've been marketed very well. Others have not been marketed very well, so that's kind of hit or miss.
Well, it kind of depends on the deal you get. So if a traditional publisher gives you a small advance, that's, you know, it's not indicative of a lot of effort on their part forthcoming. So we talked to John Goodman, you know, a few weeks ago.
From Roseanne.
Jonathan Goodman. I think he probably, that's why he goes by Jonathan professionally. I know him as John. But and there was a comment on YouTube too about, man, he spent a lot. I think his number was like $50,000 or something on
it was up there, yeah.
For the book. But yeah, it's totally different. That is not how the fiction world works. And in nonfiction, it's different because you can really like leverage an entire business around it. So the numbers are just totally different. For fiction, traditional fiction publishing works a lot like Hollywood, where most of the product just kind of exists. And then there's a few blockbusters that kind of lubricate the entire industry and keep it going. And if you don't have a pretty substantial advance, then your fiction book it's not going to have a lot of marketing behind it. And you find that even traditional authors are doing a lot of their own marketing. The difference between now and when we first started all those years ago, get off my lawn, is that there's now this whole industry of hybrid publishing, right? So I think that CJ Lyons, I think, is the first person who I ever heard use that term, hybrid publishing. She's like, I'm a hybrid publisher, right? And so anyway, I'm just going to catch myself. I didn't know if I'm allowed to say this, but I don't know why I wouldn't be. So CJ is now proudly with us. She is a Sterling and Stone storyteller, which that's been public for a little while. I was going over, am I allowed to say this? But I am. So CJ actually has, we've sold a TV show. She has a procedural coming out. And so that's this big circle. But anyway, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, when she was writing for Copyblogger, you know, she was talking about how that traditional publishers are very limited in what they know about your audience, essentially. And there's this great story that she tells where she went, you know, she marched into the publisher's office and they're like, we don't know who your readers are. And she dumps out her purse. I might be making that part up. And she's like, here's who your readers are. And all her notes.
Yeah, photos of their houses.
And they're like, how do you know who your readers are? And she had lists and she was asking. And this was at a time when publishers, traditional publishers, weren't behaving that way at all. And so she had a deal where some of her books were traditionally published and some of her books were, you know, she did her own. And that was interesting. That's like, okay, I could see how the world is going in that way. But the term hybrid publishing, and we tried it a little bit. Like, we had a couple of books that were traditionally published. They did not perform well. We were very used to being able to move the needle on our own and talk to artists.
I thought the one did. Z did.
It did okay. Like, yeah. It did okay. But it wasn't, like, one of our best ever. And considering, you know, like, we only got 15 cents on the dollar for that. And, you know, we famously could not even edit it. Like, there were some serious editing problems. And we offered to pay our publisher. We offered to pay for the editing if our publisher would just update the files. And they were like, no. And so it was, like, I cared a little too much for that. Like, it hurt. But the term hybrid publishing has changed in that before it used to be, oh, I'm published traditionally and I'm doing my own thing. Now there's a lot of hybrid publishers, which that's their industry. You know, they're, oh, rather than you being self-published, they'll help you. They'll give you an incredible cover. You can use their little imprint name. And it's not like Vanity Press in the way that Vanity Presses used to work. They're working with the author. You keep your royalties. They help to market a little bit. There's all kinds of different packages. There's all kinds of different companies. And we've talked to quite a few of these companies because on the ghostwriting side, a lot of, for fiction and nonfiction, a lot of, you know, authors who are coming in and they want a book, they don't want to do the self-publishing thing. You know, a lot of them are like, okay, I can't get my book traditionally published, but I feel like there is a market for this book. And that's absolutely true. You can absolutely have a market for your book that doesn't meet the criteria for a traditional publisher, because there's a certain number of copies they have to sell for it to be good business for them. For you, you might only need to sell 100 copies, but if it goes to the right people, you have a totally different business, right? So if you're selling consulting, if you're selling speaking, or if you, let's say you've written a really fantastic script. Here's a fiction example. You've written a really fantastic script, but Hollywood won't make anything without IP attached, so you hire a ghosting company to write the book for you. So now you have a piece of IP that you can say, oh yes, the book does exist. You need the minimums done. It's more than just getting the draft. You need somebody who will publish it for you, make sure it has the cover, make sure it has all the blurb, make sure that you get early reviews, make sure that you have the traffic, and you could just pay a company to do that. So there are services that do that, and that's what hybrid publishing is now. It has the look and feel and energy of traditional publishing, but it's a different model where you actually own the IP.
Now, originally, I think, like, hybrid publishing as we thought of it was, you know, somebody that has a book that's published with a publisher maybe once or twice a year, and then they do their own stuff independently. And sometimes they use a pen name that was similar but not quite the same as their author name. Like, Dean Koontz wrote a lot in the 70s, 80s, and his publisher didn't want to publish it all. One, because he was way out of genre. Two, he wrote too damn fast for them, and they're like, we can't, like, flood the market with this. This is my take on it. I don't know, you know, how accurate it is.
Like King Had Bachman. Right. It's the same
thing. Yeah. So,
or Nora Roberts, you know, did J.D. Robb.
Yeah, he released a lot under pen names, and those weren't independently published, but it's similar vein where he's, you know, These are the big releases, and these are the little things I'm doing just to, you know, make some extra money or get my work out there. So yeah, one of the things, you know, as Sean said, the money side. With traditional publishing, you'll get money up front. And if you're not well-known, it won't be a lot.
And there's a good chance you'll never earn out the advance.
Right. And you don't have to pay the advance back if you don't earn it out.
No, you don't. In fact, we have an advance we've never earned. Our French yesterday's gone. I think that's still, like, it might be $5 away, but I don't think it's earned out yet. So
okay. I had no line of sight. I forgot we even had those.
Yeah, well, look.
Oh, I have a copy of one. Yeah. Yeah.
The books are adorable. I remember when this came in, you're like, it's a fucking rainbow. And I'm like, it's awesome. It looks so French. So yeah, they had a deal where they gave us an advance to do seasons 1 and 2. And then if those had blown up, we'd have gotten all the seasons. And I think it sputtered. But they also released them. Like, I love that they did this, but I also see why it didn't work. They did release them each book, you know, each episode, you know,
yeah.
or two episodes, which is kind of a weird way to do it. They're not episodes, but they're two episodes. So it's 3 2-episode books per season, and then they had the seasons. I don't know, but I don't know how.
That's French, man.
Well, I don't know how the French market works, so I don't know if they were doing things that were weird or like the story itself didn't land. Like, it did okay, and one of my favorite things ever in the entire time we've been creating together is that somebody did a stop motion episode 1. Like, that's amazing, and that was it's all in French with French subtitles.
Yeah, she sent it to us back in the day on Facebook, and
yeah. So I really cool. love that. I think that's really cool. But yeah, not all advances earn out, and I would say most advances don't earn out. Again, it's the big titles that are kind of paying for all the experiments. And if you're
on that front, you do get money up front, but you're going to get a lot less on the back end. You're going to get like pennies on the dollar, like. Sort of royalty split.
Yeah, typically 15%.
Yeah, whereas Amazon, if you're priced, you know, $3 or over, you're going to get 70%, give or take. And same with the other publishers. You're going to get a larger cut if you're independently publishing. Now, the pro and con of that is if you're traditionally published and they're marketing it well, you get a smaller percent of a lot more money. So it can be very good for you. If you're independently published, you're going to get a larger percent, but you might not sell as many. So it really, it's all, you know, magic at that point. You got to really make it. You can get more, but you got to work more.
Here. I think there's a lot of personal math. I think you have to know what you're looking for, what you're willing, like, there's no one equation that is the equation, right? So your equation is going to be way different than my equation, even just right here in this window. You're always going to go, I mean, in general, you're always going to go for the equation that's a little bit safer, right? And I'm going to go for the equation that is a little more like, I know, allows for freedom, right? Allows for me to maneuver. And so already our criteria is slightly different. And, you know, short-term versus long-term is a huge thing to weigh. And, you know, one is different. If you're starting out on, like, let's say you want to do direct sales, and you know that the real money on direct sales, you're not going to make very much at first at all. Like, but once you can start bundling your product, well, now you can justify Facebook ads that go straight to a bundle. And that's something that you're not ever going to be able to do with a traditional publisher. Like, they don't bundle books like that. You know, they don't run direct sales campaigns like that. So it kind of depends. How willing are you to experiment? How willing are you to, like, figure out all these different things? How willing are you to pay somebody to do it for you? Because that's, like, I actually know somebody who's doing this. Somebody who is going and having books ghostwritten and having hybrid publishers take care of all of that, but only as a learning experience. This is somebody who does, like, they're an entrepreneur, but they're very creative. They, like, want to get into the story business. And so they're not buying their way in because they do have to learn, right? But they're working with a ghostwriter so that they can learn the craft.
It's a paid apprenticeship.
Yeah, yes, that's exactly what it is. And they're hiring a hybrid publisher, and it's a good hybrid publisher too, one of the best out there. And they're paying top dollar because they're paying attention. And part of what they're paying for is, hey, is it cool if I ask a lot of questions? I am a one-time customer, but I'm going to be a good customer, right? And so you can do it that way. That's well said, Dave. Paid apprenticeship is an excellent way to do it. If I had none of this and that's how I was starting, that is actually what I would want to do, because it would feel like the fastest path, which is just work in tandem with someone who's already done the thing that you want to do. And there's a ghostwriter and a hybrid publisher, and in general, there could be exceptions to this. So if you have a company like this, I'm not shitting on you at all. But in general, a company that has ghosting and a company that is hybrid publishing, those are two separate things. And a hybrid publisher will usually have a network of ghostwriters that they work with and refer. And same thing, a ghostwriter probably knows a few people in that space. But one business that does all of that, I haven't seen one that does all of that exceptionally well. There really are two different things, writing and publishing and repeating.
Okay, so that's your first, you know, big decision. And, you know, if you're lucky enough to get a traditional deal and that's what you want, then awesome. And it's difficult. You probably have to get an agent for most of the larger publishers. So if you're going to try and do it yourself to begin with, which is, you know, the course we took, then you have to decide, do you want to put your books out everywhere? Do you want ebooks? Do you want print books? Do you want both? Do you want your ebooks on more than one platform? Because right now, the biggest player in the game, for the United States anyway, I don't know about the rest of the world, is Amazon. And if you sign up with Amazon, you can still have your books everywhere else, unless you want to take advantage of Amazon's KDP Select. Which
you mean,
is,
if you want to take advantage of them taking advantage of you.
Yes. So basically, you trade exclusivity. And I don't know if they've changed this recently or not, but last I knew, you trade exclusivity 90 days at a time. And if you stick with them, you get to promote your books through free days. Or they also have like a countdown, not a countdown, but they have a where you can lower the price and promotion that way, and you get some more visual, like you're promoted more on their site ostensibly. But the big thing is giving your book away for free, and that's something you can do for up to 5 days for a title within a 90-day window. And then you can run BookBub ads or other, you know, all those other places like that to the book that you're trying to sell. And the idea being, you give away the first in a series, say, and then other people might buy the second, third, fourth, and so on. But to do that, you can't have your book anywhere else.
Yeah, and I would say, actually, the biggest thing isn't the free. It's that is a great benefit for sure. But the biggest thing is just that Amazon, I love you, but you're kind of cunty. And the reason you're kind of cunty is because there's a different weight. So, like, let's say this book is Amazon, or sorry, it's exclusive, right? And this one is wide. And so to see how much more weight this one has, for those of you listening, this was a visual. I was holding up maybe the biggest book I've ever written, which is a Johnny and Sean book. It's Pattern Black, and this book almost ruined Johnny. It's Unicorn Western is a little bit longer, but Unicorn Western is also 9 books, you know, each with a beginning, middle, and an end. And Pattern Black is just, it's 208,000 words, I think. And it's just one story, and it's very complicated. And so it's like Inception layers of complication. And this was the episode one and two of yesterday's Gone, the French version I was holding up. So one is very small and dainty. One is like basically a doorway. And that's how Amazon handles exclusivity. If you are exclusive to Amazon, your book has more value in the algorithms. It shows up more. It performs better. And so that's really hard for us when we made the choice to become an IP incubator with a publishing arm instead of just a publishing company. The first thing we were told by our management was, well, you need to be wide because Hollywood isn't looking at stuff in KU. Essentially, it's basically like the direct-to-DVD bin, you know, at Walmart. It's just, it's a different kind of story, and that's how it's treated. Doesn't mean there aren't some exceptions. If you get bonkers numbers, then that always matters. But I mean, for us, all the IP that we've actually moved across the finish line or close to it has been found in multiple places. So that is kind of part of the game. We expected it to our revenue to take a hit, and we buttressed for it. We prepared, but it was still shocking. Like, we thought, oh, this will be 70% over a few months, and it was like 90% immediately. It's like they really do have that hold. But there's also this thing that we've really understood over the years, which KU content and non-KU content are not the same thing. And if you write non-KU content and expect it to perform really well in KU, you're going to have diminished results. Whereas on the other hand, if you engineer something for KU and for that audience and for how they consume and for how they appreciate the tropes, then your stuff's always going to do better. So it's not just a question of should I be wide or should I be exclusive? It's what kind of content can I sustainably create and where is the best placement for that content?
Now, KDP, select content that does very well, traditionally genre fiction, romance, yeah. What else?
It's very genre and it's series, right? So if you think about it, like for me, I love standalones. It's the same reason in TV, like my favorite TV is limited series in general. Like there are some series that I just love, but in general, I love a limited series. And I'll like American Primeval a tiny bit less if it's not a limited series. Like I think they already told their story.
So you're a snob, okay.
No, it's not that at all. It's like, okay, one of my favorite limited series from the last few years was Bad Sisters on Apple. Have you seen that?
No.
You would love it. You would just love it. It's so good. It's very Irish. It doesn't matter. You would really like it. And it was kind of a perfect limited series. And then it did really well, and Apple went ahead and greenlit a season two. There should never have been a season two. Like, there just shouldn't have been. It went from being like kind of a perfect show to, oh, well, now there's the season two. And I just... whatever, like, but publishing is the same. A standalone book is just so much less profitable. Like, I get why it happens. I totally get it. It's because, hey, we're investing millions of dollars in getting this thing to market, and now we have an audience who's paying attention. So a lot of the heavy lifting for a second season is already done. Like, the audience is already there. So I absolutely get it on a commercial business sense. Absolutely. But as a consumer, I like standalones. As a creator, I like standalones. And so I get that. KU is like, it's not standalones. It is series. And you only, now think about the economics of this. You're getting paid like a fraction of a fraction of a penny per page, right? So it is a bulk game. Now, that's plus and minus. The minus is you obviously have to have a lot of content out there for the numbers to work. If you only have a book or two, you're just not going to make the money. It's near impossible. You have to be very, very lucky. But if you have a proper funnel, like we've talked about this from the very beginning, then the books get more profitable over time. And so, for example, I was talking to someone at Author Nation who had a whopping 58 books in a series. That
wow.
is an insane number of books. I would lose track and I would lose interest as the creator. But I admire that. Like, that's a very working funnel. But your read-through has to be good, right? If you're not giving someone a reason to push through the series, that's a problem. And we have one storyteller in the company that has a 94% read-through rate. Like, that is phenomenal. And that means that we can pour a lot of money and attention into a book one because we know that eventually that gets very profitable. And, you know, we actually had this situation where they wrote six books in a series and the read-through was, and that was all that was planned, but the read-through was so great that we were like, you're going to write another six, right? And that funnel got so much more valuable because it's twice as long and we're still only spending money on book one, right, to send traffic.
Now, yeah, KDP appeals to like voracious readers, people that they enjoy reading and they want to read a lot. And I think when they find a series that they really connect with, they want to read more of it. It's like finding a really good buffet. You know, like, you can go and have a fine steak, but if you really like the chicken wings at that buffet down the street, well, load up. And I think one of the things you said about the having many books in, like, one, like 90 books in a series or whatever, I do see like fantasy authors that do like groups of series, but in the same world. So that's one way to get around that, having, you can keep it fresh by having it in the same world, and then you have that crossover.
That's the MCU play, and that's really smart. That's really smart. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much what Anderle did, right? Where he had his core series, and there was like a billion series that were all satellites orbiting in and around. So, yeah, I think the MCU play is definitely a smart way to handle KU.
So once a reader or a writer, has figured out, you know, whether they want to go wide or whether they want to, you know, try with Amazon. Well, the next step is to basically publish your book. And the best way to do that, you know, obviously, if you're only going to Amazon, it's not a big deal. You just go through KDP Select and you do that. Now, there's services if you want to go wide, and I'm going to get to print books in a bit. If you want to go wide, though, you can go to other services that, like Draft to Digital, and you upload to one place, and they will siphon it off to all the retailers, so you don't have to manage multiple dashboards and stuff. What's your thoughts on that, like best practices?
I absolutely think using an aggregator makes so much more sense. I think anything in business, it's what is the simplest thing? Because simple is repeatable, simple is sustainable. I mean, you don't want to be stupid and do something just because it looks like the simplest thing or the easiest thing. But if you have, you know, one dashboard that gives you access to, you know, 90 different places, I mean, I'm making that number up, but in the time that we've been using Draft to Digital, the tool just got better and better and better, and you can, you know, upload to libraries and you can upload to all the major platforms. That's really, really valuable, not just for saving time when you're publishing for the first time, but maintenance. If you need to update a file, if you need to track, you know, one dashboard that has all your sales in one place, that's really, really valuable. Now, there are some instances, like, for example, Apple doesn't give a shit if you're straight up with Apple or Draft to Digital. And if they don't give a shit, you should never be straight with Apple because it's complicated. Like, their dashboards, I don't know, maybe they aren't anymore, but at the time that we were using them, they were very, very complicated. And it was like, oh, this is like way, way more difficult. It's siloed away from the rest of our stuff. And the reps at Apple don't even care at iBooks. But on the other hand, there was Kobo, and Kobo did care, right? If you weren't going through their dashboard, then you weren't privy to their sales and their like specials and their promotions and things like that. So you would make a decision, well, am I going for ease or am I going for profitability? And so for us, we actually did Kobo Direct back in the day, but that was because we had a relationship with Mark from Kobo, who is no longer from Kobo. Now he's Draft to Digital. So, you know, the relationship went there, and that just makes the most sense, is to go with what is the, I think, most sustainable thing.
Now, when it comes to print books, you know, Amazon still has their print on demand, and then there's like Ingram Spark. And there's also, you know, if you want to do like special editions, which are all the rage, and I think that's only when you have an audience should you be doing that. If you have like a big audience, especially genre like romance or fantasy or romanticy, those special editions with the spray painted spine, not the spines, but the page ends and the foil covers is all very beautiful. There's like a Book Vault, I think, is one of the companies that does that.
Yeah, Book Vault's also great. It's not just, I would argue that it's not just when you have a big audience. So, for example, we have Plot 147, which is a book I wrote with Catherine Cottom. It's coming out next month. No, it's February already. It's coming out this month. And we're still in the very early stages of getting a website built and doing all this, but we're not selling it on Amazon. We're actually selling it direct. And we'll talk about that in the future, the why and all of that. But we're selling it direct, and Book Vault is actually better, from what I understand. We're doing some discovery around this right now. But Book Vault is better at print on demand and just getting a few copies here rather than Ingram Spark, which is better at getting distribution and getting in other places. But if you just want like somebody to land on your site and you want to be able to sell them, you know, a book, Bookvault is a great solution for that. So that's probably what we will be using for Plot 147.
Okay. So, yeah, and we'll get into the, you know, direct selling and stuff like that in another episode, because that is, you know, a whole different thing.
It's
a whole
different box, strategy. Yeah, and it's not a publishing decision. It's a publishing related decision, but it's a very strategic business. Okay, I'm just gonna really swim upstream and go that way, because it's not easier by any stretch. But if you have the catalog, if you have the ambition, like, there is a lot of potential there.
So, what do you think are some of the mistakes or things we would do differently if we were starting off today and still had like a number of books to start with, not the 1,000 we have right now, but I mean, let's just say we had a good number of backlist, like 25 books or something. How would you do it now? Would you go exclusive with Amazon? Would it be dependent on genre? How would you handle it?
Well, I love this, because I don't know if it's a real question or if you're being rhetorical right now. Because
a little bit of both.
this is exactly what we're doing. So we have a plenty of stuff on Amazon, but we are building this, you know, little microsite that's just basically there for our fiction. And we're gonna start with a lot of like standalones and things that just aren't really easy to sell on Amazon and would be easier to sell to an audience. You know, we do have our fiction list, and we can, you know, say, hey, I wrote this book. It's not on Amazon, but if you like it, you can get it here. And that's an interesting way to play it. And as we go forward, you and I have a lot of books, you know, that we've written together, and we can start putting those on the site one at a time. And the way to make direct sales work is with bundles, because it's how you make Facebook ads work and how you make them profitable. So you need the right things to bundle together. So for example, I know that, you know, Johnny is really big on direct sales and doing the artist and author thing, but the roadblock he has...
We're going to have him on in an episode or two to talk about that.
Yes, episode after next, I believe. And then so when you know, with him selling direct in that way... His biggest obstacle is that his stuff isn't genre related. Like, it's harder to sell a box set of Unicorn Western and Namaste and Robot Proletariat. Like, they're all very, very different stories. And so, you know, we were doing some direct sales with some other stuff at Sterling and Stone, and it was like, oh, well, you could package all of this stuff together, right? So genre really helps. But even having said that, communication helps. You don't get that with Amazon. Like, you don't know who your buyers are. I'm a good communicator. I'm a good storyteller. So if I can have somebody on my list and I explain why book A, B, or C, you know, why they might be interested in it, well, I'll move smaller numbers, because Amazon's going to be like just a massive beast if you ever catch their wind and they start selling emails for you or sending emails. But you have to catch that wind. And on your direct, you have more control over that. So I feel like that direct connection also is the easier path long term, because you have that relationship. You have people who are much, much more likely to become true fans in that context than in this context over there. And so that's another reason to do it. But I also think that if you are going direct, then you have to do a better job. Like, you do. So for us, we are not just like starting a site day after tomorrow and then all of our stuff is available day one. Like, it's just going to be slower than that. Not only because we have to create SKUs and, you know, get the shopping carts and all of that for each product, but because each product should be exceptional. So like, I'm doing daily YouTube content to market my fiction, knowing that it's going to take a year before that actually adds up to anything. But best time to start anything like that is yesterday, right? So we've been dropping YouTube content constantly and, you know, letting that tick along. But on the site, there should be more meat for a reader to get lost in. So for example, last month was John Titor, was the book that we released under my name. And on, it's actually the only book that exists on the dummy staging site for the website that we have right now. But right now it's just a page. But what it will be someday, it will have, you know, the trailer, and it will have links to some of the best, you know, tighter videos that I did. And there's a couple of songs that were written around the book, and that page, yeah, Dave can laugh, and the page, you know, can have, because there's already lyric videos for, I think, three of them. The page should be there. So if somebody lands on this page, they're actually going on an adventure. There's a lot to read about this book. There's a lot of curiosity. And that makes you, as a storyteller, a lot more interesting. And then they're like, oh, well, maybe that book's not for me, but I'm going to click over here to this other book. So each page is like something that's a little more immersive than the typical author buy me page.
And I mean, this kind of goes into the whole promotion side of it, and we're going to talk more on that in a later episode. But I do, ever since we started, you know, building this fiction site and thinking about what's going to be there and how we want to bundle stuff, it got me thinking about all of the books that I've written that I really love the stories. And, you know, when I've been doing the audiobooks for some of the short stories we've done, it's like, wow, something happens when you're in the churn of putting books out on Amazon, because you're in a rush to, like, fill that furnace and then get on to the next thing. So I never really, early days different, but nowadays, in the past, you know, after the first year or two, I never really sat with a book to enjoy it after the fact, or promote it in any way whatsoever, or talk about it, or let anyone know it existed. Like, now that we have this site where we can just tell people about it, and, like, through email, through newsletter and stuff like that, you know, share stories. Because I'm thinking about, you know, why did I write this book? What was I thinking at the time? What question did it begin with? Like, yesterday's gone. What would happen if you woke up and, like, everybody in the world was gone except for, like, a few people? What the fuck happened? That's what we wanted to answer in that book series. So beginning with a question like that sparked an idea. And I think sharing that with your audience, especially if you're cultivating a readership, as hopefully you will or have already, that allows you a little more control over the buying process. You are building a relationship, you are sharing what makes your books good, what makes your stories good, and directing them too. They can still buy at Amazon if they want, or they can buy directly from you. And I feel it's a very different experience, and it allows me more space to think about stories we've already written, stories I want to do in the future, and changes how I would plan it out in the future as well.
Yeah, I really agree, and I feel like it's a really great opportunity right now for a lot of authors are worrying about how to go faster, and I feel like that game's already lost. You know, like, rapid release killed that shit. You have to do a book a month to keep up with it. That's obnoxious. And then now AI, like, if you could do a book a day or a book a week or whatever, like, people can't read that much. You know, like, what you have is your identity as a creator. And so create better stories, create better bonding experiences, and you'll hear me double down on that all the time. I'm not going to use AI to try and go faster so much as use AI to try to be better. How do I tell different stories? And Dave can make fun of these songs all they want, but, like, it doesn't matter. It's you know, we did this, like, cool dossier for John Titor, and I used AI for that. Like, it wasn't part of the story. It was like, hey, help me do, like, this cool little classified document, you know, that, you know, that's a really good use for it. It's a little extra cookie. You know, making cookies, not the cookies you love, Dave, but the cookies.
Oh, I was going to say, when AI makes cookies, whew.
Right, that's, like, a great way to do it. Like, hey, character bios or different things that you can kind of get your reader to be really interested in and feel like, how do you hook them in? How do you pull them in deeper into your worlds? And you can do that. You can make a really cool web page that isn't the same. Like, you could do A+ content on Amazon, and that's great, and we're definitely leaning into that where it makes sense. But also, that's not the same as being on your own website and being able to really control what the experience of your visitor is like.
Yeah, and I think that's especially true for the genre fiction, like romance, fantasy, sci-fi, where readers become fans of they really want to get into the world. They really want to, you know, fall in love with the characters or whatever. So if you have a series like that and you're able to explore those characters and worlds more on your own website with added stuff, that just puts you ahead of every other writer that you're competing with, I think, anyway. So,
agree.
Well, that's it for this episode. We had that little lull, and we're going to be back next week with the next publishing, right? Publish, repeat, the next publishing episode. So look forward to that. Until then, go to authorvelocity.com, where we have information on Author Velocity, if you'd like to learn about that, and also things that'll help you become a better writer. Tools. 10 Days to Flow is fucking awesome, and we're giving it away for free because we love you and Sean's crazy. So that's it for this week.
All right. We're going to iron that out over time. We love you all. We'll see you next week. Adios.
Bye.
The shadows of the Sunshine State, redacted, is his home. Lives a man named David Wright, who pens The Great Unknown. Diet Coke runs through his veins, a decoy wallet keeps him rich. Paranoia fuels his pen, and creativity's his niche. Write, publish, repeat.